You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of people say they plan to work after retirement. Far fewer people actually do. That's just one finding of a new survey that shows a mismatch between our beliefs about retirement and the reality for people who are actually retired. Now, a new report from the organization Human Rights for Kids finds that Wisconsin has the second highest percentage in the nation of prisoners who are incarcerated for crimes committed when they were 17 years old or younger. Wisconsin is one of just three states, along with Texas and Georgia, that automatically tries 17-year-olds in adult court. The research has found this may increase the likelihood of future crimes. We're talking about the criminal justice system here in Wisconsin and how it works for youth offenders, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think 17-year-olds should be tried as adults in some or all cases? What changes do you want to see to the juvenile criminal justice system here in Wisconsin? Is this something that's affected you personally or maybe a family member? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Caldwell is a recently retired lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison and a former senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
So we've got over 7% of the people who are incarcerated in Wisconsin being there for crimes they committed with 17 or younger, second highest rate in the nation. Can you talk about the significance of that number?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the statutory structure that we have, where 17-year-olds are considered to be adults for prosecution for anything else, like buying a car or anything else. They're still considered to be a child. But so as a result, that by itself puts a lot of 17-year-olds into the system. And then, of course, there's always a problem with how you deal with younger kids, 16, 15-year-olds who do particularly terrible crimes, who do homicides or armed robberies or things like that. And so exactly what's the best way to proceed with that? If you have them in a traditional juvenile commitment, you only have them under supervision until 18 or in some cases into the early 20s. But for a lot of crimes, that seems like a fairly short period of time to really get adequate rehabilitation. So it's a reflection of the structure of the particular statutes in the state and the way that we allocate our resources.
And as I mentioned, Wisconsin, just one of three states that automatically treats 17-year-olds as adults. Do other states have, more of an optional system where depending on the crime or the particular case, a 17-year-old could be treated as a juvenile or an adult?
That's right. Virtually all states, I think all states, have a mechanism where a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old who commits a particularly bad crime can be moved into adult court and handled as an adult. And in some states, that's requires a petition from the prosecutor. In other states, they have different mechanisms. Typically, though, it goes to some sort of a hearing, and a judge makes a determination as to whether it's best to handle this case in juvenile court or adult court.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of having this 17-year-old automatically treated as an adult in Wisconsin? It goes back, I believe, to a law passed in the 1990s?
That's right. In the 1990s, beginning in the late 80s and into the mid-90s, we saw a huge jump in homicides and violent crimes by adolescents, by teens in the United States. And there was a lot of misunderstanding about that. That's where the super predator scare kind of got going. And almost every state adopted some kind of statute changes to try to be more restrictive with adolescents and to try to crack down on this. And Wisconsin made a number of changes in our laws, including moving 17-year-olds into adult court. Part of the thinking there was, at that point, we had two juvenile institutions, Ethan Allen, two secured juvenile institutions, Ethan Allen and Lincoln Hills, and I guess there was a third for girls. Those were both way over census and struggling to keep up. It was costing counties a lot of money to house kids in those facilities. And so part of the hope was that if we moved the 17-year-olds out of those facilities and into the adult system, that would free up money for prevention programs at the county level. That was one of the considerations. It didn't actually work. We didn't see a drop-off in admissions to those facilities. What we did see, though, was by the time that law was fully enacted and put into place, we were about 3 or 4 years into a decline in juvenile violence and in violence across the board. And that decline continued for the next 20 or 25 years until just very recently. And it had really nothing to do with tightening up those laws. And in fact, in some ways, it looks as though some of those more restrictive laws backfired. So most states have backed away from those 1990 laws and changed it so that they have moved 16 and 17-year-olds back into the juvenile system and made it a little bit different as far as how kids are waived into adult court and a number of other changes. Wisconsin has not made, I don't think, it made many changes to those laws that we passed in the 1990s.
And Michael, I wanted to ask, we've got just about 30 years, I guess, of evidence now. What do we know about if we incarcerate that 17-year-old versus going to the juvenile system? What have we learned about whether they're likely to commit another crime in the future?
Yeah, this has been studied in a number of places. I'm not sure if there's been a specific study done in Wisconsin, but it's been thoroughly examined in lots of other places. And what we find is that the kid who is actually transferred into the adult system is actually slightly more likely to commit another crime once they get out. It actually aggravates the situation. For juveniles in general or teenagers in general, the idea that they might be waived into adult court doesn't seem to have any deterrent effect, doesn't slow them down or prevent them from committing crimes. So one of the problems with these waiver laws is that they don't seem to be effective at reducing crime at all and may have a marginal effect on increasing crime down the road. The other issue is that across the board, when you put very young individuals into the adult prison system, they just, with long sentences, they do very, very poorly. They have much higher rates of suicide. They get into a lot more fights. They're victimized a lot more. They just have a very tough time making that adjustment because, for a lot of reasons, but especially if you're 17 and you are facing, say, a 20-year prison sentence, that's longer than you've been alive. And it's hard for a 17-year-old not to just lose any sense of hope and not see much point in participating in rehabilitation programming and some of those kinds of things. So you routinely see very poor adjustment in those first few years with these young guys.
We're finding out why Wisconsin's criminal justice system is an outlier and how it deals with 17-year-old defendants and the impact on younger people in the courts. Our guest is Michael Caldwell, former lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison, former senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin should handle juvenile offenders, those under 18? What works, do you think? What doesn't? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Michael Caldwell, former lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison, former senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center, taking a look at the impacts of trying 17-year-olds as adults. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one been through the juvenile criminal justice system in Wisconsin or tried as an adult at age 17? Can you share your thoughts on that experience? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hello.
Hi. I want to bring up the statistics from the FBI for last year for Milwaukee and just kind of open everybody's eyes about what we're talking about here in Milwaukee. The FBI statistics from last year clearly show Milwaukee has a higher murder rate per 100,000 people than the city of Chicago. I am 61. I've lived here my whole life. I have never, ever seen things as bad as they are right now in Milwaukee. Teenagers are a huge part of this totally out of control crime. Every other day, you see teenagers stealing cars and crashing them in the wildest videos. I say, if you're 14, 15, you go to adult prison. If you want to do adult crimes like murder, carjacking, some drug dealing, you should get the book thrown at you, lock you up, throw away the keys.
Ray, I gotcha. Michael, what do you think? Ray perceives, and there are some numbers, especially with those homicide rates in Milwaukee. They have certainly gone up in recent years.
Yeah, in the last couple of years, since COVID, we've seen a number of cities that have had spikes in their homicide rates, and also these auto theft kind of a fad among some teens that's promoted by videos on social media and the like. And the caller's reaction is, I think, a natural. This is the way that people almost always react to crime. It's if you've ever been a crime victim, your first reaction is you want that the person that harmed you to suffer. And so it's a completely understandable feeling. And it's one of those things that it does drive a lot of these laws that we've seen passed going back into the 1990s. The other side of the coin, of course, is that we've had this situation in Wisconsin for a long time. As you mentioned, we have some of the highest rates of adolescents going into the adult prison system, and we still have this spike in homicides and car thefts and violent crime. It doesn't seem to have protected us at all in that regard. And that's consistent with the broader research that although it does make us feel like there's some justice to that's inflicted on people who have done bad things, it doesn't seem to prevent things getting worse, and it doesn't head off the next crime victim, prevent them from suffering that harm.
Thanks for the call, Ray. Andy is with us next in Appleton. Andy, hello.
Hi. There's a real movement towards, just like the last caller said, to impose mandatory sentences and throw the book at them as if that's going to make a difference in the crime rate. But recently, Tommy Thompson, who really pushed truth in sentencing in the same mentality, said he really regrets that and ended up didn't do anything to change the crime rates, because when people are going through this crime, they don't think about those things. And it's really blown out the state budget as far as how many people we have in prison and taking care of them. So he regretted that push under truth in sentencing just the last couple of months.
Thanks for that call, Andy. And I believe the former governor had also advocated for ending treating all 17-year-olds as adults in the court system. Your thoughts on that, Michael?
Yeah, the push for moving young offenders, 17-year-olds, back into the juvenile system has the interesting thing about this is that it really isn't a Democratic position or a Republican position. There doesn't seem to be a particularly clear-cut status as far as the politics of it. We've seen quite a bit of push from fiscal conservatives on the right who recognize that this is just a waste of taxpayer money. It's an ineffective way to try to manage the problem, just as Governor Thompson was alluding to. And, of course, on the other side, we've seen advocacy groups like the group that produced this report talking about the fact that it's inconsistent with international standards on the treatment of children and human rights and those kinds of things. It seems to be that we can't move the ball forward on this and address it in a way that's more just simply more effective. It's not just simply a bad policy, partially because we are so locked into this retributive system that we have. But I think that the area, the side that is most likely to move these policies in a more effective direction actually is the fiscal conservatives on the right. They seem to have been able to make the most progress on actually changing some of these policies.
Thanks for the call, Andy. Sheila joins us next in Milwaukee. Sheila, hello.
Hi. I was strong-arm carjacked a month and a half ago. They targeted me and followed me into my driveway. At any rate, I was beat up pretty bad, and I fought back, which was probably not the smartest thing to do at 50 years old, but I did anyway. And the point being is I don't believe that a 17-year-old, if we're going to make them adults at 17, then make it a clear-cut line. Now you're an adult at 17. What is the point of being 17 if you're not still an adolescent? And the young man that attacked me was 16 years old. And I don't feel these kids feel that they're loved in Milwaukee. You know, we used to have things in the justice system like the boot camps and other things to rehabilitate them. And we don't have those things to offer them anymore. We have nothing for these kids to do. They're not supposed to be in the parks after 9 o'clock at night. Well, that's great. We used to play Ghost in the Graveyard when we were kids. We did all kinds of things like that. But we had the opportunity to do those things, and they don't. So if we're not going to give them things to do and make it constructive, then there is no point. I mean, if we're not going to grab these kids by their bootstraps and make them respect and respond and feel loved and want to love life, because they have no respect for their own lives.
And Sheila, I'm so sorry you went through that, and thanks for being willing to share it. For the 16-year-old person who attacked you, I mean, do you feel with your mind or with your heart they should be tried as an adult? They shouldn't? Are you mixed on that? I don't know.
Absolutely not. No, he's still a child.
Sheila, thank you so much for calling in. And Michael, interesting, certainly, perspective there. And Sheila, feeling... we need solutions before we get to this stage of asking the question whether this kid should be in prison.
Yeah, that's right. And I want to echo your feeling. I'm sorry that happened to the caller, but it is these are difficult issues because these kids do commit some very violent and heinous crimes. So it's not just that we should feel sorry for them or those kinds of things. At the end of the day, a lot of times the things that lead states to make these changes is that they just simply recognize that these are ineffective policies that cost an awful lot of taxpayer money. It's just you're just burning money and not accomplishing much. The other issue here is that we know now over the last 30 years or so, we've seen some very, very effective rehabilitation programs that have been developed and studied and can work even with fairly violent kids in the community also with the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center's studies showing that even the most violent kids, the most difficult to manage kids, if they're treated in the right, using the right methods, we can reduce the risk of violent recidivism by half. But at that point, as the caller kind of alluded, once the kid does a crime, you're quite a ways down the road, and it would be ideal to have programming that happens earlier and prevents that first crime from even happening. And that's in some ways a little bit harder to work out, but it's also the more fertile ground to try to spend your energy in.
Thanks again for calling in. Pete joins us next in Wausau. Pete, hello.
Hello, Dr. Caldwell. I find it interesting that the system and the laws that you mentioned that changed in the 1990s and the juxtaposition between what we know now about adolescent brain development and risk of recidivism as far as conducting intake evaluations and assigning risk assessments or assigning risk levels to maximum, medium, and so on and so forth.
I got to jump in because we're just about out of time. But Michael, adolescent brain development and how we evaluate future risk when somebody is brought into the court system.
And that's an important consideration because when you have someone in, say serving a 10-year prison sentence in the adult system, it just makes sense not to give them, say, anger management or alcohol and drug treatment in the first year and then have them sit for 9 years until you release them. So a lot of those services are held until they're close to release. The trouble is that we know from adolescent brain studies that the younger adults and teenagers are most likely to change in those early years, in those teen years. And so the most effective place to put that treatment into place and work on that rehabilitation is when they're younger. And so that's how the juvenile system is structured. You have rehabilitation built into everything the kid goes through from day one. And in the adult system, of course, for very logical reasons, it's often held until near the end. So taking advantage of that neurodevelopment and also recognizing that kids, adolescents, just simply don't have the same capacity to control some of those impulses, to think rationally, and to manage their behavior and manage risk and see the potential harms that could come. They just simply don't have the same capacity that an adult does. And that will develop as they get older.
Pete, thanks a lot for that call. And Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Michael Caldwell, recently retired lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison, former senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center. He talked to us about why Wisconsin's one of just three states that automatically tries 17-year-olds as adults. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, electricity rates went up this year for many people here in Wisconsin. Find out what the rate increase means for you and how those prices are set in the first place. And if you've noticed, if you're feeling that increase, love to hear from you. You can email right now at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, 1A honors Tina Turner's fiercely graceful life and music, and they're inviting your memories as well. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, retirement planning can be complicated and confusing, and a new survey finds that many people's expectations don't match up with the realities of retirement. That survey comes from the Employee Benefit Research Institute. It included over 1,000 retirees and over 1,000 people who are still in the workforce. One finding, over 70% of current workers expect to make money by working after retirement. But hang on, only about 30% of retirees actually bring home money from employment. Workers also had different expectations about when they would retire and how much of a role Social Security would play in their post-retirement finances. Our next guest follows retirement issues and working later in life, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you recently retired, did everything go according to plan, or did you retire maybe earlier than you wanted to? Did you want to work after retiring? If so, are you working? And if you're looking ahead at retirement, however far down the road, what are some of the biggest things that you find confusing, hard to predict, hard to get started on even thinking about? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Carrie Hannon is a career transition, retirement, and personal finance expert. She's a senior columnist at Yahoo Finance. Her latest book is called In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. Carrie, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, it's fantastic to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
One of the most striking things about that survey is that stat I mentioned. Most people, by a fair margin, think, yeah, I'm going to keep making money by working after retirement. Minority of people actually do that after they retire. What do you make of that big difference?
Yeah, you know, I think that there is this idea that we're going to be able to continue working. And what happens is simply life gets in the way, right? I mean, there are a couple of things that can happen. It's normally a health issue, or some sort of disability that may keep you out of the workplace. And it can also simply be ageism. You know, it's deeply embedded in our culture, in the workplace, and it might be just a bit harder to get back to work or continue to work than people imagine it's going to be. So there are things you can do to make it more possible for you, but there really is a huge gap here in what people expect to do in earning money in retirement and what actually happens.
Now, for that person who is trying to figure out what their post-retirement finances might look like, what would you say to them if they said, yeah, a good portion of my retirement is going to come from working after retirement? How might they adjust their thoughts based on this survey?
Well, you know, the point is you need to, if you think that's what you want to do, you have to do all of those things to make this a possibility for you. You need to start thinking in advance, line some things up. And these can be contract work opportunities. So it doesn't mean pedal to the metal as it was before, but try to line some things up. Make sure that your skills are relevant, that you have skills that are up to date, because no employer is going to take you on if they have to train you to do a new job. So you need to make sure you're current in the skills that you have and that have a real, you know, take the time ahead of time to scope out what might be possible for you. And I do think an important thing to remember is remote work coming out of the pandemic. Remote work took off. It's here to stay. Yes, employers love hybrid situations these days, but for retired workers or someone who has a health issue that doesn't want to deal with the commute anywhere, remote jobs are a great way to go. And you don't have to work for somebody in your town. These are global opportunities.
I want to stay on this subject before we move on to other parts of this survey, because you've written a couple, since this piece came out, you've written a couple of things related to it. And maybe some good news here. Another survey of employers says it looks like over time they're getting more willing to hire and keep older workers. What do we see there?
Oh, I so love that. Yeah, thank you for noting that. Transamerica Institute came out with a recent survey that said that, hey, you know, employers are finally saying that, yeah, we are, you know, giving a great deal of consideration to workers over 50 or more considerable attention to them, which is something they didn't say in the past. They also noted that they are offering more workplace training programs to help retain their older workers and other situations looking for more flexible opportunities. These are all great things that employers, I mean, I got to tell you, you know, this as well as many of the listeners out there, is that it's a reality that employers need to keep older workers on the job, whether it's on a part-time basis, on a flexible basis, because sheer demographics, there are just not as many younger workers coming up through the system because of the fallout in fertility rates, which started a long time ago. It's a global issue, but in order to keep their workforce, they need to hang on to these older workers.
And another piece, just scrolling through your list, Carrie, gives us tons of ideas for topics here. You wrote about, again, for these seniors, either older workers looking to change careers or maybe thinking about that post-retirement job, adult education programs can be a goldmine. What is out there?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of this. And it's so important that people, as I mentioned at the top, you know, you have to keep your skills relevant and up to date for whatever the position you're looking to do is. And coming out of the pandemic, virtual learning opportunities absolutely exploded. I mean, we're not talking, you don't have to go get a degree or spend a ton of money. You can really just cherry pick. I want to do this particular skill. And if you go online, there's from the big universities down to, you know, just smaller programs, you can find programs that you can do virtually as well as go in person. You know, the community college system still offers a great deal, but the opportunities that both universities, colleges, and then some other more nuanced groups are starting to offer classes really aimed at the older student. And again, let me tell you, this goes back to demographics, because they are seeing a shortage of this, the younger people coming up in traditional, that 4-year university experience, perhaps, or longer with a master's or a PhD or what have you. But they need to build out lifelong learning, or long life learning, as we like to call it, because there is this longevity. People are living longer. for the most part. And so say, you know, it's not just one and done, 4 years of college and you're out. They need to build systems where people are learning throughout their lifespan. And this is what we're seeing starting to happen. And I really encourage workers who are interested in staying in the workplace in some way, earning an income, to, you know, have some financial security as you age. This is a wonderful thing to do for yourself. But take a look around, and they can look at my article, but there's plenty of resources out there.
Talking to Carrie Hannon, columnist at Yahoo Finance, author of books including In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. We're talking about a recent survey that shows we have a lot of expectations about retirement that don't match up with the realities for retired people when it comes to things like working, timing of retirement, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you retire earlier than planned? Have you worked after retirement? What did it take to get a job post-retirement? Join in with your experiences or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with finance columnist Carrie Hannon about retirement and why our expectations don't always match up with reality. Recent survey found a big gap between what people thought would happen in retirement, the timing of retirement, if they'd keep working, and what actually happens. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Russell is with us in Taylor County. Russell, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I was listening to the program just now, and I work for a delivery service that owns white trucks, not brown ones, and I'm 75 years old. I had 30 years in one of the branches of the service, and I'm a retired officer, and I taught school for a long time, and I just can't emphasize hard enough that you have to stay engaged with this life, and I don't mean just a little bit. You have to stay fully engaged with the life. And that's my way of doing it. I'm outside. It's a beautiful day in northern Wisconsin. I've had a great time driving, just as I always do. It's a lot of physical work. I make a little bit of walking around money. It's a great way to go.
And Russell, you're in pretty good shape, it sounds like, at 75.
Well, you know, for a long time I wasn't.
Yeah.
I was just, you know, kind of doing jobs that were easy to do. And so I deliberately took a job that's not easy physically to do.
Interesting. Russell, thanks for that call and sharing your experience. More power to you. Carrie, great for Russell. What should other people be thinking about if they want to work at 75? Yeah.
Well, Rob, thanks. You know, I just want to chime in with Russell. Way to go. Because that's another point to make. It's not all about the money. Yes, that's nice to have, as he called it, walking around money, or maybe even more. But what continuing to work in retirement years is also part of socialization. It's about having a reason to get up in the morning, out doing something physical and engaged in the world. And that is, that mental benefit is so important to remember. And I do think that work, people get caught up in it being sort of a four-letter word, when in fact, it is really something that can be super positive in all kinds of parts of our lives.
Russell, thanks so much for calling in. John joins us now in Duluth. John, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, the main point I would make was, it would be, it's great to pursue the things that you were interested in but didn't have time when you were working, or felt guilty doing them because you should actually be doing your work-related stuff. But what I would recommend to people is, before you retire, like let's say a year before you retire, and it might be hard to do, but calculate what your budget is going to be, what your actual retirement income is going to be, and then live according to that budget for a year. And then the money that you don't spend, then you can put that away in a savings account. So when you retire, you know, I just had a furnace bill on expensively for $711. When I was working, well, okay, I can do that. You know, when you're retired, that's a big chunk out of a retirement check. So that was the hardest thing, is you retire and you're used to having twice the income and you don't have that anymore.
John, thanks for calling. I think a lot of important steps there, Carrie. First of all, talking the idea of calculating how much money am I going to make after I retire.
Yes, John, thank you for bringing that up for Rob and me, because that's a point. So many people don't take the time to run their numbers. It's, you know, it sounds kind of daunting. They'll get to it eventually, or they don't want to even think about it. But if you can plan ahead and at least get a rough, there are lots of retirement calculators online. You can maybe work with a financial advisor or whatever it is that's going to work for you. But if you can take that time and really focus on what's it going to look like, what's it, what are my, do that budget, as you said, John, it really can make a huge difference in how people really navigate this next chapter in their lives.
John, thanks a lot for sharing that. I appreciate it. Getting back to the survey we started with, here's another interesting misconception. People underestimate the role of Social Security income as they anticipate retirement. What did we learn there?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the EBRI study showed that only a third of workers, 33%, expect Social Security will be a major source of income in retirement. But guess what? The majority of retirees say it is. So there is this disconnect. They're not fit doing that budget, running those expected numbers. And frankly, the Social Security Administration, you can go right online now at their website, and there are ways that you can get a good bead on what your monthly check is likely to be. And then you work from there and find out what, how big a source of income is that going to be? Do you need to bring in additional income from some sort of work after retirement? And some of those things you and I discussed earlier, Rob.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chloe is with us in Clinton. Chloe, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was a reluctant retiree. I did not want to retire, but at the age of 72, I felt compelled because of my required minimum distributions for my investments going back to the government if I continued working. But I needed the intellectual stimulation and socialization of working with other people. So I now volunteer more than 40 hours a week.
Wow.
With our Rotary Club and the SCORE organization as a mentor, and I couldn't be happier.
And Chloe, I got to ask, what was your job that you were so happy to stick with?
I did international project management for a firm that manufactures hematology instruments.
Wow. Chloe, thanks so much for sharing that. Carrie, what do you think of Chloe's story?
Chloe, way to go again. I mean, I love this idea of working and making it, you know, working not for pay necessarily, but making an impact, giving back. And I mean, as a project manager, I can be quite assured that you can do almost anything you're asked to do in an organization. And so this is really important for people to remember, because you are also getting those benefits of engaging with the world, you know, getting out of your head and into the world and having that socialization, that mental stimulation, all those great things. But at the same time, you're giving back. So I think this is an example that a lot of people should consider.
Chloe, thanks for sharing that. And Carrie, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Oh, Rob, thank you. Thank you.
That was Carrie Hannon, career transition, retirement, and personal finance expert. She's a senior columnist at Yahoo Finance. Her latest book is In Control at 50 Plus, How to Succeed in the New World of Work. By the way, the article that Carrie wrote that triggered this conversation, we've got it linked over at WPR.org/Central Time, looking at retirement, why our expectations don't always match up with reality. You can keep sharing your story of how retirement worked for you or how you're hoping it's going to work for you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Did things work out differently for you? In a good way, in a bad way, a little of both. Love to hear your story. Again, you could email ideas@WPR.org. In February, a gunman opened fire on the campus of Michigan State University. It was the latest case of a mass shooting on a college campus. As political debates about how to stop mass shootings have stalled, Rich Kramer reports it's up to law enforcement agencies like UW-Madison's police department to teach officers how to stop them once the shooting starts.
You can feel the blast from the 9mm blank as it reverberates down the concrete hallways of UW-Madison's vacant Biotron laboratory. A light cloud of dust falls from ceiling tiles as the sound of hurried footsteps gets louder.
Where did they come from?
A UWPD officer is wearing a plastic face mask and carrying a training pistol that fires high-powered paintballs. He rushes toward the shots, passing colleagues covered in fake blood lying on the ground. Inside a room, another officer, posing as a mass shooter, is waiting. In the melee, a number of UWPD officers and the faux shooter are hit by paint rounds that leave weeping red welts. The April training scenarios are loosely based on past mass shootings at businesses, schools, and universities. There's no single definition of a mass shooting, but by one measure, there have been more than 200 of them this year. The frequency of shootings means simulations like these have become a routine part of law enforcement training. UWPD Lieutenant Jeff Ellis says the department studies mass shootings that happened in Wisconsin and beyond. It's a grim reality, but he says officers have to be ready if it happens at UW-Madison.
I mean, we need to be our best that day. And so I think when we do look at it, yeah, it'd be great if this wasn't as prevalent as it is. You know, I think that's why we study as hard as we do. That's why we train the way we do.
An awareness that shootings can happen on campus affects student life, too. At UW-Madison's Memorial Union Terrace on the shore of Lake Mendota, PhD candidate Vrishank Jambur sits on the grass with friends. The students here are unaware of the training on the other side of campus. Mass shootings didn't happen during his childhood in India, and Jambur says he never thought about them.
Once you come here and once you start hearing about it, that's when you start, you know, feeling a little scared.
Freshman Mary Bear of Minneapolis and Simona Latacina of Chicago had a very different childhood. They trained on how to respond to mass shootings in school. Bear says they were called Code Red drills in Minnesota.
I've always sort of been told that it's not an if, it's more just of a when it's going to be something that I have to deal with. And so every time that I'm sort of in a large space, I'm always kind of told to find the nearest exit and sort of just have a mental preparation of how I was going to deal with something like this.
Latacina's high school had metal detectors at the doors. On normal days, she says one out of 20 students would be asked to walk through. If there was a threat, she says they'd all be screened and the line would round the block.
So that was definitely a really scary situation.
Francie Crapo-Hobson is a professor of school psychology at the University of Colorado, Denver. She says the stress from repetitive stories about school shootings can take a mental toll on young people, but research shows that well-designed drills with prior education can boost perceptions of safety.
It should never be a surprise, because otherwise people believe there's a real-life threat, and that is terrifying.
Former Madison Middle School teacher Abigail Sweats says pre-planned drills she and her students were part of were still terrifying.
It was always in the back of my mind that if this were real, I would put my body on the line for my students.
Sweats, who now works in the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, says she favors more restrictions on gun ownership. But in the absence of new laws, she says it's often up to schools and students to prevent deaths. Back at the UWPD simulation, officers are focused on how to respond effectively. Lieutenant and instructor Adam Boardman says it's up to them to stop the shooting.
I'm not going to stand outside and wait for people to get shot. I'm the one with the gear and the training and the firearms. It's my job, even if I, in the back of my head, don't want to do that, right? You don't want to go in there, but that's what you have to do.
It's one way that law enforcement training for mass shootings has changed over time. The mantra during their training is, stop the killing, then stop the dying. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at the long-term impact of childhood trauma and adverse childhood experiences from the lens of primate research, find out what some of our animal cousins do to recover from trauma, and then back to the human world and look at efforts to deal with adverse childhood experiences here in Wisconsin. Also tomorrow, housing costs are high in many Wisconsin communities, big and small. We'll check out new efforts to bring those costs down, including a conversation with a state lawmaker, part of a package of bills aimed at dealing with the high costs of housing here in Wisconsin. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. This one sounds pretty interesting to me. From cumin and yogurt to raisins and cheese, we'll find out why some flavors work together sometimes in surprising ways. We'll talk to the author of a book called The Flavor Thesaurus about ways to combine familiar flavors in unfamiliar ways. If you have a favorite unusual combination that works for you, or one you've encountered that doesn't work for you, tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.